again, this is in no way to exonerate in any size, shape, form, or manner what O.J. Simpson did back then, but the move to recall that judge at this time, in the immediate aftermath of the O.J. Simpson case, to my way of thinking, connotes perhaps an unconscious presupposition, but a presupposition of guilt, the basic rationalization or the basic rationale behind recalling the judge is that his negligence in not imposing sufficiently stiff sentence on O.J. Simpson somehow resulted in this greater harm, and that has yet to be proved. Perhaps that's the case. But again, the strange contradiction in physical evidence leads me to want to see an investigation or some serious questions asked that have not been asked. The handling of the case continues to get stranger and stranger, but the manipulation of the case and the knee-jerk reaction on the part of a number of people, law and order advocates have been banging the drum. Elements of the women's movement have been banging the drum, and certainly, again, as I said before, the whole question of spousal abuse or partner abuse is one that should be more intelligently and rigorously addressed than it has been to date. But I want to emphasize that the questions that I have concerning the O.J. Simpson case concern the physical evidence and the legal handling, and they are, to a certain extent, at least completely irrelevant from O.J. Simpson's past, which indeed could have been used to set him up for exactly this sort of thing. The screechings of right-wing radio talk show hosts about just about anything that Bill Clinton has done in the past, and the banging the drum over such things as a polyclass case, the three strikes and you're outlaw, which I suspect could make outlaws of an awful lot of people over the years, and which I think in the event of an economic collapse, a very real possibility as we watch the dollar become shakier and shakier on 626.94. The possibility of an economic collapse and resulting political catastrophe is one that should not be too readily discarded, and I think that preparations are now being made to do some serious butt-kicking in the event that that happens. I think the American people in a variety of ways are being programmed in such a way as to be prepared for a police state, to be prepared for fascism, to be prepared for a military coup, either in part or in whole. And I think the talk show hosts are leading the way, the right-wing talk show hosts, the three strikes and you're outlaw, the hue and cry to lock up people, when in fact, at least on 626.94, crime is on the decline. The hue and cry over such seemingly non-political things as the caning of a fellow named Michael Fay, this teenager, who supposedly defaced some vehicles over in Singapore. That spurred an entire vein which was mined by the right-wing talk show hosts and law and order fanatics to say that basically the problem here in the United States is lax law enforcement, that with the sorts of draconian law enforcement measures that have kept Singapore sidewalks free of chewing gum and spit, as well as the cars free of graffiti, if those were implemented here, well, by God, we'd be a whole lot better off, and we wouldn't have all these disrespectful kids and all this crime and all this mess, etc., etc., etc. I suspect that that sort of knee-jerk response to what I see as a program, and a deliberate program, of psychological and of political indoctrination and psychological warfare, that type of reaction, I think, in a time of political crisis could very easily lead to the calm judgment of business necessity and a successful judgment of business necessity, which James Stuart Martin saw as bringing fascism to America. James Stuart Martin, head of the economic warfare section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice during World War II, the author of the book All Honorable Men, which was formed an integral part of the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, and was quoted in part three of The Seeds of Nuremberg. An article was carried, a brief article, in the San Francisco Examiner of Saturday, June 25th of 1994, in their Bay Datelines section. There was an interesting little article about a campaign ploy and a statement made by the female opponent of Democratic Congressman Ron Dellums of Berkeley, one of the more successful and more progressive members of the House of Representatives, and currently in charge, much to the chagrin of much of the political right, of the House Armed Services Committee. This concept, this statement, this political and psychological campaign gambit, I think, in many ways could be seen and understood as representing what, for lack of a better term, could be called right-wing talk show recombinant political DNA. And I submit under that category the following, Dateline Oakland, and headlined, Cain Wife Abusers, Says Candidate. A Republican running to unseat Representative Ron Dellums, Democrat of Berkeley, in November, says men who abuse their wives should be caned. Deborah Wright advocates the Singapore-style punishment instead of jail for convicted wife abusers. She says men who beat their wives should have a taste of their own medicine. Quote, women do not press charges in many cases because they rely on men economically, unquote, Wright said in a press release. Caning allows the man to be severely punished without losing his job, unquote. Wright doesn't advocate caning for any other felony. An interesting bit of, again, what I see as a right-wing talk show cross-pollination, in which one could, for lack of a better term, term this, Michael Fay meets O.J. Simpson meets Gloria Steinem meets Adolf Hitler under the circumstances. I think that the mere fact of such an ideological and propagandistic recombinant DNA appearing on the scene at this time in the wake of the O.J. Simpson brouhaha, whatever the objective truth of the charges against Simpson, is symptomatic of the response of a population that has been subjected to the types of psychological warfare ploys that were laid down 500 years before Christ by Sun Tzu and quoted, not incidentally, by Reinhard Galen in his memoirs. I, again, do not know precisely what happened with the O.J. Simpson case, but I have a strong supposition that his evident history of white beating notwithstanding, O.J. Simpson is being set up. And I think whatever the objective facts of that hunch, the fact of the matter is the psychological manipulation of the case is something that it should be noted and noted very carefully. This is a profound political phenomenon and something that is not to be overlooked. Again, Cain Wife Abusers, says candidate. Again, right-wing talk show, political recombinant DNA. We're going to launch into the main body of tonight's prepared portion right now. Once again, I want to read a couple of things. I read them a few minutes ago. I'm going to read them again, and I'm going to read them again later in the program. So those of you who hate repetition, tough stuff, as they say in the business. I'm repeating these because I want these concepts to echo in people's minds as they listen to the information that I'm presenting during the rest of the broadcast. Because in many ways, I think the stratagems that I perceive to be at work here in the United States and elsewhere are dependent on these principles. Once again, from Reinhard Galen's memoirs, The Service, The Memoirs of General Reinhard Galen, the following. I will conclude this chapter with an extract from the rules for political and psychological subversion laid down by the Chinese Sun Tzu about 500 years before Christ. Quote, there is no art higher than that of destroying the enemy's resistance without a fight on the battlefield. The direct tactic of war is necessary only on the battlefield, but only the indirect tactic can lead to a real and lasting victory. Now again, in place of enemy, one can substitute a population targeted for fascist takeover under the circumstances. Continuing, subvert anything of value in the enemy's country. Implicate the emissaries of the major powers in criminal undertakings. Undermine their position and destroy their reputation in other ways as well, and expose them to the public ridicule of their fellow citizens. Do not shun the aid of even the lowest and most despicable people. Disrupt the work of their government with every means you can. Spread disunity and dispute among the citizens of the enemy's country. Turn the young against the old. Use every means to destroy their arms, their supplies, and the discipline of the enemy's forces. Debase old traditions and accepted gods. Be generous with promises and rewards to purchase intelligence and accomplices. Send out your secret agents in all directions. Do not skimp with money or with promises, for they yield a high return. Remember those principles, because what we're going to be looking at during the course of the program this evening in large measure is how the discreditation of politics in general and politicians in general paves the way psychologically and politically for the entry of the man on the white horse, the savior from outside, the one who will right all of the wrongdoing and make everybody happy in the process. That is the promise held out by fascism. It is the ideological mystification upon which fascism relies to a large extent for its success. And we're going to be looking, first of all, at the application of the discreditation of politics and politicians in of that tactic in Italy as preparation for the rise to power of the right-wing slash fascist coalition of Silvio Berlusconi. Of the rise of that coalition and the consequent institution in a formal way of fascists in the government of Italy. In fact, they've been there for a long time, but now they are formally in the Italian government and in a position of real power. I'm going to quote some material from a right-wing newsletter that I would recommend that people monitor. It is, as I said, a right-wing newsletter, but it affords some very valuable insights into the political outlook that I think is dominant to a large extent in the circles of power, not only in this country, but elsewhere as well. Research credit on this goes to a listener. This is from Strategic Investment. That is the name of the newsletter. Once again, Strategic Investment of May 25th of 1994. In a column entitled This Month, we find the following introduction, a quote from William Pfaff, P-F-A-F-F. Democratic political systems are a recent affair in historical terms. They had a brief existence in Greece and Rome, afterward reemerging in the 19th century, fewer than 200 years ago. A cycle of repudiation may now have begun. Italy leads the way. And the columnist here, the writer, goes on to comment, Most North Americans are more interested in Italian food than Italian politics. Yet while attention here was preoccupied with the death of Richard Nixon and the NHL and NBA playoffs, Italian politics were shaken by an earthquake. Silvio Berlusconi, B-E-R-L-U-S-C-O-N-I, the billionaire financier who entered politics only 4 months ago, swept to victory in Italy's most important election in decades. I see Berlusconi's triumph as a leading indicator of the death of politics in other Western countries. It has important implications. And we're going to ponder the first of those implications as seen by this columnist. One, Berlusconi's victory is another confirmation of my thesis of last month, stating that a heightened sensitivity to corruption is a leading indicator of change. I think couched between the lines of that sentence are some levels of meaning that are perhaps far more important and far more sinister than might be apparent on first glance. Bear in mind, as we proceed through the Italian political landscape, the firestorm of criticism, scandalization that is now being directed at Bill Clinton. An individual I'm not exactly crazy about, but nonetheless I've never seen such a firestorm of media venom directed at any political figure in, that I can recall offhand. Continuing, within with this column here, within the past 18 months, magistrates have revealed the systematic corruption of Italy's ruling political circles. The politicians and parties that dominated Italy since World War II were exposed to investigation and indictment for political tricks that they and their predecessors had pursued unmolested for 40 years. And indeed, that investigation, Operation Clean Hands, was to a large extent investigating some of the political misdeeds that had indeed dominated Italian politics for decades. Political misdeeds grouped around a center of occult political power in Italy called the P2 Lodge, or a Propaganda Due Lodge. The P2 Lodge is a Masonic lodge headed up by former Mussolini backer and Waffen-SS officer Licio Gelli. It is comprised of people of influence in various circles of Italian life, national security, business, and cultural, as well as organized crime. And the P2 Lodge has wielded profound influence not only over the Italian military and Italian secret services, but it has many important foreign connections as well, including and especially here in the United States. Gelli, for example, as I said earlier, was an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's 1981 inauguration and has been a performer of favors for a number of American political weights for quite some time. The investigation, the investigations pursued under the title of Operation Clean Hands have resulted not only in a bunch of suspicious political, deaths in Italy, but also in the reinstitution or the reappearance of right-wing terror as a vehicle for intimidating and halting of those investigations. We're going to go into Gladio 2 or the Strategy of Tension 2 a little bit later. We've talked about it before. We're going to go back to it for a period of time. We should note, though, for the purposes of the present discussion, that the P2 Lodge is front and center in a number of archive shows. Most importantly, it figures prominently in Radio Free America programs 17 through 21, dealing with the circumstances surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul I in May of 1981. In particular, Radio Free America shows 18 and 19 concentrate fundamentally on the P2 Lodge, the Vatican banking scandals, the strategy of tension, the super seize me, and the evolution of many of those elements on up through the shooting of Pope John Paul II, which appears to have been a provocation involving, among other elements, P2-related elements. The evolution of those forces is traced not only throughout the Radio Free America series, numbers 17 through 21, but is picked up later in a miscellaneous archive show about Operation Gladio, and in Radio Free America programs 32 and 34, and the miscellaneous two-part archive series about the fascist third position. There is an interesting sidelight to the victory that was achieved by the Italian fascists. And bear in mind this ominous quote here at the top of this column by William Pfaff in Strategic Investment, a right-wing investment advisory letter. Democratic political systems are a recent affair in historical terms. They had a brief existence in Greece and Rome, afterward re-emerging in the 19th century fewer than 200 years ago. A cycle of repudiation may now have begun. Italy leads the way. We are going to touch briefly now on a series of articles that we are going to go into at great length. That series of articles is in a very fine British anti-fascist publication called The Searchlight, about which I shall have more to say in a minute. But in one of those articles entitled Italy Moves Towards Fascism, subtitled As Europe Prepares to Celebrate D-Day Anniversary, in a banner on the side is labeled Italian Elections. The first two paragraphs of this article read as follows. Oh, by the way, this is from the Searchlight's issue number 227 from May of 1994, and research credit for this entire series of articles goes to a listener, a very diligent listener, and many, many thanks to that member of the listening audience. The first two paragraphs of the article entitled Italy Moved Towards, As Europe Prepares to Celebrate D-Day Anniversary, Italy moved towards moves towards Fascism, we find the following. The far right has begun its battle for power in Italy. In elections on the 27th and 28th of March, the ultra-rightist Freedom Alliance, with majorities in both houses of the Italian Parliament, the Chamber of Deputies, and the Senate. The victory of the ultra-right was greeted by a financial mini-boom in which the value of the lira soared momentarily, and in which the prices of shares in almost all of Italy's top industrial concerns rose in stock markets around the world. That little section of the right-wing investment advisory letter, Strategic Investment, looming large in the background of that particular aspect of events in Italy. In the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show entitled Uncle Sam at Il Duce, American Support for Mussolini and the Mythology of the Corporate State, we went into Mussolini's corporate state, the great favor with which that political concept was greeted among American industrial and financial circles, or in American industrial and financial circles. We also took a look at the profound support given to Mussolini, not only by key elements of those industrial and financial circles who helped to prop up the failing fascist economy of Italy, but also the very favorable coverage given to Italian fascism in the American media as well as elsewhere. And it would sound, on the basis of that piece of information, as though the repudiation of democratic process, which according to William Pfaff is being led by Italy, is being met with great favor in investment circles. One, I think, would not require a great deal of information in order to see that as representing confirmation of the continued support for the corporate state in industrial and financial circles around the world. A small article from the San Francisco Chronicle about Operation Clean Hands is going to launch our discussion into a hard analysis of Italian political events. We're going to be coming back to the Searchlight articles in a big way in just a minute. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, May 13th of 1994. In the World Report section of the Chronicle, we find the following article. This is from Europe. It's Dateline Milan and headline, Former Premier Charged in Italian Bank Scandal. It reads, no longer protected by parliamentary immunity, Bettino Craxi, C-R-A-X-I, one of Italy's most powerful politicians, was ordered yesterday to turn over his passport and stand trial next month. The former socialist premier was indicted in connection with Italy's biggest post-war banking scandal, the 1982 collapse of Banco Ambrosiano, said reports yesterday by the Italian news agency AGI and RAI State TV. Also indicted by Judge Maurizio Grigo was former Justice Minister Claudio Martelli and Licio Gelli, who once headed the shadowy P2 secret lodge that was investigated in the 1980s for suspected subversion, the reports said. Well, the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano, in which, in connection with which Bettino Craxi and Licio Gelli have been indicted, is something that is a major focal point of the aforementioned Radio Free America program number 18, the first of two Radio Free America shows dealing explicitly and entirely with the P2 Lodge, both in Italy and elsewhere. Bettino Craxi is a name that is not only inextricably linked with the P2 political milieu in Italy, it is specifically one of the main political names that is connected to the political career of Silvio Berlusconi, the former P2 member and the head of the right-wing fascist coalition currently administering Italian politics. We're going to take a look at Berlusconi's government, his connections with the P2, the historical evolution of not only the Berlusconi-Craxi Association, but also the Berlusconi and Licio Gelli Association. We're going to see not only how the P2 milieu was instrumental in the rise of Silvio Berlusconi as a media magnate, we're going to take a look at how that success was a critical element, the media component, so to speak, of a political strategy formulated and enunciated by Licio Gelli in 1976 called the peaceful rebirth, a peaceful return of fascism to Italy. Research credit on all of the information that I'm going to be presenting for section of the broadcast dealing with Berlusconi and the P2. Research credit on all of these articles goes to a listener, and this information comes from a very important British anti-fascist publication that I alluded to just a minute ago and read a short section of. The publication is called The Searchlight, subtitled The International Anti-Fascist Monthly, not to be confused with the American publication Spotlight, which is of an opposite ideological stripe. This is from the Searchlight magazine of May of 1994, which had a six-page section devoted to the Italian elections and the re-emergence of Italian fascism in a formal above-ground sense. By the way, the Searchlight can be contacted for subscriptions at the following. Their address, Searchlight Magazine Limited, at 37B, as in Baker, New Cavendish Street, Cavendish, London, W1M8JasonR. W William 1 Mary 8 J as in Jason, R as in Roger. W1M8JR. And the phone 071-271-284-4040. For sales and circulation inquiries, 071-284-4040. 071-284-4040. For a fax, 071-284-4410. 071-284-4410. The address, one more time, Searchlight Magazine Limited, 37B, as in Baker, New Cavendish Street, London, W1M8JR, 071-284-4040. Also, there's another number under here. I don't know what this indicates. ISSN 0262-4591. ISSN 0262-4591. All of these articles, again, from the Searchlight magazine, May of 1994. And we're going to begin by taking a look at a sidebar in this particular series of articles about the Berlusconi connections with P2 and his role in the peaceful rebirth, or the democratic rebirth. It actually is called both the peaceful and the plan for a democratic rebirth. In fact, the democratic rebirth of fascism here is a misnomer if ever there was one. They use democratic means, but it's anything but a democratic rebirth. In a sidebar, there is a synoptic account of what the P2 Lodge is, and for the benefit primarily of newer listeners who are not familiar with the P2 Lodge, I'm going to kick off this discussion of Berlusconi, the P2, and the democratic rebirth of fascism with this particular sidebar. It's called The Perversive Conspiracy of Geli and P2. By the way, Geli, L-I-C-I-O, is Licio, and Geli, G-E-L-L-I. P2 was a secret fascist Masonic lodge whose existence was first revealed after raids on the villa of Licio Geli in 1981. The first disclosures, which proved that more than 1,000 political, military, police, intelligence, media, financial, and criminal personalities were members, caused the fall of the Italian government of the day. P2 was shown to have been central to numerous political, financial, and criminal scandals, including at least one serious conspiracy to overthrow the elected government after destabilizing it through murderous terrorist actions carried out with the assistance of organized crime. By the way, one of those coup attempts was the 1970 coup led by Mussolini fascist Prince Giusto Valerio Borghese, P2 member and organized crime functionary Michele Sindona, a Vatican financial advisor, was the conduit of money that was channeled from the Central Intelligence Agency to the Giusto Valerio Borghese coup attempt and the related strategy of tension. That was the program of right-wing terror meant to be blamed on the left in order to destabilize the government and prepare the way for the Borghese coup attempt. Again, that coup attempt, as well as the strategy of tension, was financed in part and supported by the CIA, and Michele Sindona was the conduit for the CIA money. Weapons not only for the Borghese coup attempt, but for a later coup group, the Rose de Venti, or Rose of the Winds coup group, also involving Michele Sindona, among others. The supplier of weapons for the Borghese coup attempt was none other than former SS colonel and Nazi commando extraordinaire Otto Skorzeny, a post-World War II Reinhard Gehlen operative working both for CIA and BND, while at the same time serving as the linchpin of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground fraternal organization and political machine. And so the Borghese coup attempt and the strategy of tension hatched or conceptualized by Stefano Della Chiai, the Italian fascist, in many ways served to illustrate and embody the political alliances which the P2 was able to realize, alliances which went far beyond Italy, and alliances which are very, very significant for us here in the United States. Continuing with this sidebar, P2 was at the center of the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano, a bank with extensive links to both the Vatican and the Mafia, in the summer of 1982. This bank funneled millions of dollars to extreme right-wing governments and parties, especially in Latin America. Roberto Calvi, by the way, another Vatican financial advisor and also a P2 member, Roberto Calvi fled to London and was found hanged there in June of 1982. Licio Geli, P2's Grand Master, who had close ties to NATO's Gladio network and the Mafia, escaped from the Swiss prison cell in 1983 and fled to Uruguay. In December of 1985, he was charged with 14 others for involvement in the Bologna fascist bomb massacre in which 85 people were killed. He was sentenced to 10 years jail. Geli, 75, was the author of a long-term plan for taking power. A close associate in P2 was Silvio Berlusconi. Geli later returned to Italy. In spring of 1994, the legal authorities demanded that his acquittal on appeal in the Bologna case be reversed and that he should serve his 10-year sentence. P2 has been illegal since an Italian court found it to be, quote, subversive, unquote.